This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it's great to have you with us on our radio Main Street across North Dakota this time of day. We're going to start our show today talking about transgender issues. When it comes to trans-specific health issues, for example, patients don't have many options. Faye Seidler is a longtime activist for transgender rights, and she runs the Harbor Health Clinic in downtown Fargo. She joined John Harris for this week's Prairie Pulse television show, and here is some of their discussion.
Faye, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
As we get started, tell the folks a little bit about yourself and your background.
I've done a lot of work in this area for transgender advocacy, education, and rights, and I've done quite a few things for that in the last couple of years. I've written for the High Plains Reader for about 2 years doing Trans Corner. I led the North Dakota Safe Zone Project that did research into looking at how to prevent discriminatory actions from happening in businesses, schools, government, just kind of all kinds of wakes of life. Beyond that, I've done a lot with Tri-State Transgender, which is a support group in this area. And recently I started Harbor Health Clinic, which is a clinic that treats trans patients. I do a lot of the stuff I do in this community because I didn't have any of it growing up. As a trans woman myself, I grew up in North Dakota. I grew up to our awful winters, to our unpredictable weather most of the time. And I grew up in the rural communities where there's this 10 to 100 people there and you pretty much knew everyone. And I didn't have a lot of resources or support growing up. I didn't have anyone I could turn to, anyone I could talk to, anyone who could help me. And a lot of the individuals that are there to help you when you fall, whether they be your parents, your friends, your guidance counselors, coaches, principals, therapists, whoever, they didn't have the adequate tools to help me when I was growing up in this state. So a little bit about my background is I do a little bit of everything for the trans community, the greater LGBTQ plus community, and just marginalized communities in general, mostly because I didn't have those resources or tools when I was growing up.
You say the clinic. Let's turn to the clinic.
Sure.
What is your role at the clinic?
I am the administrator of Harbor Health Clinic, which means I kind of do the day-to-day functions of the clinic. And that could be a lot to do with scheduling patients of the clinic, talking to them, making sure that they know when they should go to the clinic, where it's at. I also do a lot of the back-end things in terms of maintaining the website of our clinic, writing grants for it, looking for spaces and opportunities for our clinic to be able to grow. Just kind of everything that's not directly doing medicine and everything that's not directly being part of the nonprofit that hosts our clinic is my job.
Okay. How did the clinic start and why?
That's actually a great story. Dr. Richard Lenzmeyer, who's a doctor at our clinic, approached me when he was working at Family Healthcare, and he said, I've been looking at transgender healthcare, and I'm wondering how we are doing in our area in terms of supporting trans clients and trans patients. So I was like, that's great. Let me send you an email. And that was about a 5-page email that I originally sent him. Afterwards, he's like, well, we should probably meet and talk about this. So then I met him and we talked for about 2-3 hours where I was talking about the need for healthcare for trans individuals because it's... Before we started this clinic, we had one endocrinologist in North Dakota of 700,000 people that was treating trans patients, which means that patients were taking between 3 to 6 months to even be seen. Because they're going through Sanford, they don't have much options for reducing any of the costs of the medical care, so they're paying upwards of $1,500. So imagine going in for any other routine care visit and them saying, well, we can see you in about 6 months, and then having to wait that long before they will even give you any kind of treatment. So before we started this clinic, there was almost nothing out there for people. And when Dr. Richard Lenzmeyer approached me and asked me about this, he got a wealth of information about the need of it. And then he and I worked together. We eventually contacted Cody Severson, the president of Community Uplift Program. And together we created this clinic from scratch, basically.
Okay. Where is it located?
This clinic is actually downtown Fargo in the regional small business office, which is across the street from the Wells Fargo kitty corner to that gas station. Just downtown Fargo.
Now, are there other clinics like this in North Dakota?
There are other places that will treat trans individuals for transition-related care, but there are no clinics in this state that offer sliding fee scale service, which means that if someone is not making, if someone is in the poverty line, if someone's not making that much money, or they have other situations going on, like maybe they've just been let go from a job, something like that, our clinic is able to reduce the cost of their visit to nothing if need be, to make sure they get the medical care that they need. A clinic like ours, there's not another one around until you get to the Twin Cities, pretty much.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned Dr. Linsmeyer. What's his specialty and his involvement with the clinic?
So he is our primary care doctor at the clinic. And his specialty, he's done a lot over the decades of being a medical care provider. He's done a lot with homeless health specifically. But one of the incredible things about him is I didn't know anything about him until he talked to me about a year and a half ago about this clinic, about trans people, about what they needed. And since then, I do a lot of advocacy and education. So I do trainings at other hospitals like Prairie St. John's and places like those. And the amount of doctors, nurses, and social workers who knew who Dr. Richard Linsmeyer was incredible to me. Like, all these people knew of this guy and the incredible work that he did in the community, that he's always done in this community for decades, pretty much. And learning about that through other people as I started to learn about his own work myself was just incredible to me. Like, he is one of the best doctors that I've ever encountered or talked to, like, in my life. He's just an incredible doctor.
What is an informed consent clinic? What does that mean?
So all medicine operates with the idea of informed consent, which means that you need to give a patient all the risk and benefits of medication for them to be able to make their own consent of care. And a lot of this is implied. A lot of times informed consent is implied. If you go into a clinic for a basic flu shot, you understand, you know, there are going to be risk, there are going to be benefits, et cetera, et cetera. For the purposes of a transition-related clinic, a gender-affirming hormone therapy clinic like ourselves, informed consent means that we understand that patients have the agency to make their own health decisions. So if we give them all the risk and benefits of pursuing hormone therapy, they can make an informed consent decision to pursue that therapy. This is different than regular hormone therapy has been up to about 2010 and on, where you often had to have a letter of referral from a therapist qualifying you for this therapy. We've actually seen that a lot of current research has shown that a person does not need to go through a therapist to get a letter of referral, that hormone therapy is very safe and effective. Trans individuals are usually very aware of their own conditions and needs, and what we do is try to make it so they can access those with as little barriers as possible, whether it be so they can see our clinic right away and start getting medication they need, whether it be because they can't afford other places and need to go through our clinic. For our clinic, it's about accessibility, and most informed clinics, the ones that we are like, operate under these similar models.
Mm-hmm. Are there times when you do require patients see a therapist prior to treatment?
There are times, because if a patient is experiencing severe emotional distress, they cannot give informed consent. So if a person has any kind of mental or physical risk that we think would be a deterrent for this treatment, that's something where we'd look into as a case-by-case basis. And in some cases, yes, recommend they see a therapist for a little bit before pursuing treatment at our clinic.
Okay. How does gender-affirming hormone therapy work?
Effectively. It works well. Modern research has understood trans individuals to effectively have an endocrine disorder, meaning that they had the wrong hormones throughout most of their life. And there's consequence to that. Obviously, your body is going to develop different than it should. Your mood and energy are going to be different than it should. But what we do is establish the correct hormones for individuals to make sure that they are what you'd say cisnormative and that their body can operate how it was supposed to. So hormone therapy, the effects of it, what it does for individuals, is it brings their body into balance with what it should be.
Okay. Is this potentially risky or dangerous?
Hormone therapy is proven very safe and very effective according to the World Professional Association of Transgender Health. This is new stuff for a lot of people. But what they don't see is that we've been doing research into the trans condition outside of America. 1910, we were doing research into this in other countries. In America, we've been doing research in this since the 1950s with Harry Benjamin taking on Kristen Jorgensen as a patient. 1950s, 60s, 70s, we've had now 60 years of research into this. From a medical standpoint, we can see this treatment as being very safe, very effective, very proven.
What kind of medical or health issues, you know, may come with hormone therapy?
There are some associated risks. There's not things I can get too much into since I am not a medical doctor. Obviously, I can't make any medical claims on the medication, but there are going to be risks associated with it, but they are the risks associated with hormones in any individual. Like estrogen the higher estrogen, the more risk for blood clots, and that's going to be true for trans women taking hormones. Blood pressure is a thing you have to look at if you're taking testosterone if your testosterone is too high. Those are some of the risks we look at, but when you sit down with our doctor, there is things that we look at in terms of if you have this medical history, if you have this family history, will this be a concern? And we always try to mitigate those risks and let people know about them. But for majority of patients, they don't have to really worry about it. For the most people, especially if you're in your younger years, you're not going to really have to expect many complications, if any.
Okay. Does insurance cover such medical procedures?
That's hard to answer. It can. In Minnesota, it can. In Minnesota, it absolutely does, no matter what your insurance is, as long as you're getting it from the state in some capacity, either through the MSure exchange or through Medicare or Medicaid, it does. But each insurance company is a little bit different. If the insurance is coming through a government or government-funded organization, then it has to adhere to the ACA, the Affordable Care Act. And the Affordable Care Act means it cannot discriminate against trans individuals, which means if they get a treatment that any cisgender or / not trans individual can get, you can't say no to them. However, there are some places that interpret hormone therapy as something you would do to get surgery. And they don't actually have to cover transitional rated surgery for many states, for many employers. So they can justify not covering a lot of the cost by saying that anything you do as a trans person to transition is related to surgery in some capacity, which not trans people they don't have to get, which means they can deny it. So there's not an easy answer to that question, and there's a lot of bureaucracy that goes around what is covered and what isn't. I will say that in the U.S. Trans Survey, a survey that was conducted in 2015, surveying 28,000 trans individuals, they found something like, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it was 33% of trans individuals reported their insurance not covering their medical needs. So nationally, about a third of trans individuals with insurance are not getting much benefit from it.
Mm-hmm. So how do you work with patients who have trouble paying?
Well, we are a nonprofit clinic, so we take donations. We take insurance from other people who do have it that can. For people who can't pay, we have a sliding fee scale option for them. Depending on what they make, if they don't make much, maybe we could reduce their bill by 50% or 60% or 70% or 100% if they aren't able to afford it. If they don't qualify for the sliding fee scale, but they have other life events going on, that's something where we can talk with them and say, hey, you can't necessarily pay this, we understand that, but how much can you pay each month? How much can you contribute to it? So we have a lot of patients who are able to pay and are able to make it so we have that sustainability costs. And those patients make it so the people who cannot, who are not as fortunate, are still able to get the medical care that they need.
Mm-hmm. As an activist or whatever, yep. Can you talk about the advances of in the last few years, I guess, of recognition of transgendered rights?
Kind of like what I was saying earlier in terms of in the last 5 to 10 years, mm-hmm. The idea of being trans is culturally really new. In North Dakota, it's especially new. But that's actually part of because of how medicine used to be practiced. In the 1960s and 70s, when we treated a trans patient, what we did was we said, well, to be safe, what you need to do is completely abscond from your previous identity, move to someplace else, and never refer to ever being born as anything other than you are. And they encouraged that because they felt that was the safest thing that they could do for these people, these patients coming to them. And to a point, it was. It was safe for them because they got to be able to establish in a new place with a new identity and live their life as happy as can be. But that meant we didn't get much visibility. We didn't get a lot of conversations like were happening now, like should have been happening since the 60s, 70s, and 80s. We're now just starting to have these conversations. And for a very long time, trans individuals weren't the ones talking about their stories, weren't having the conversations. It was always about trans individuals. And if you look at media representation, at least, trans individuals often showed up as sex workers with, like, CSI Miami or shows like that. It was very rarely a fleshed-out trans character like you would see in today's shows like Sense8 or the mini-movies we've had in the last couple of years. Personally, I think Laverne Cox doing the interview, it was a trans tipping point, I believe, was a cover of it. And that was in 2014, if I'm not mistaken. I could be. But I think that was a really big pivotal turning point, because that was when we started to actually see trans individuals having a voice in this discussion. When we started seeing a lot of trans individuals of color, having a lot of power and agency to define our own condition. And that visibility has been something that has cascaded into more visibility. As we have more people standing up and being role models, as we have more education out there, more people feel safe to come out, safe to have these conversations. And the more people that we have having these conversations, the more people are going to. In 2008, I want to say, the visibility for trans individuals was about 8%, which means 8% of individuals personally knew someone who was trans. In 2015 or 2016, they found that 16% of people personally knew someone who was trans. So 16% of people personally knew someone who was trans, which means 84% of people didn't know someone who was trans, which means all the information that they were getting that was informing their decisions was coming from news stations or television shows and not the actual living, breathing people that live through being trans. I think we've seen a lot more visibility since 5 to 10 years ago, and we've had a lot more conversations, and that's something that we are going to continue to have, these moments of education and visibility going forward. So I think trans rights are going to be coming. It's a slow but gradual battle into success.
Okay. Do you think the state of North Dakota at the legislative level is doing much to address the issues for LGBT?
I don't think they're doing anything to address the issues. If you followed the last decade of anti-discrimination legislation hearings, it is very often a couple hours of testimony and support from religious leaders, people in religious communities saying we need this, we need these protections. People in business communities saying that we need to be competitive in the national market, and that's usually what I write about when I talk about these issues. There's a lot of different reasons why we really need this, and we have a lot of different community leaders across North Dakota saying that we need this. And we have hours of testimony from dozens of people representing dozens of backgrounds saying we need this. And then we have two or three people saying we don't need this, we don't want this, this will violate my rights in some capacity. And then we get a vote that says, do not pass these legislations. It goes to the floor and we get a vote that says, discrimination doesn't happen, we don't have to worry about this. Regardless if it does or it doesn't, that sends a message to people. It sends a message that if you do experience that, they are not going to care. That no one will hear your experiences, no one will actually be there to support or help you. And if you want to go back to how I was talking about in terms of growing up in this state, when you don't have that support, it's hard to live here. And what we find is a lot of LGBTQ plus individuals move from this state because they don't feel safe here. We have the lowest population of trans individuals of any state in the United States, according to the William Institute. So legislatively, they haven't done anything, and they've sent very strong messages that they don't want to. We might see different with House Bill 1441 is happening right now, which is going to protect sexual orientation. But I really doubt that we're in a place culturally where we will see those legislation. I think we have a lot more conversation and education before we will see more statewide change.
As Faye predicted, North Dakota House Bill 1441 did indeed fail. Last month, the House voted it down 70-22. We'll hear the rest of John Harris's interview with Faye Seidler after this.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Easter Seals Goodwill and the Inc., providing support for children, adults, and families in need across North Dakota, thanks to donated goods at their Goodwill retail stores. Learn more at esgwnd.org, because a better community starts with you.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. Today we're sharing a discussion with transgender activist Faye Seidler with the Harbor Health Clinic in downtown Fargo. She's talking with Prairie Pulse host John Harris, and here's more of what they had to talk about.
Can you talk in general about some of the success stories that you've helped or treated at the clinic?
So not specifically the clinic, but one of the things that has given me the most hope is I hosted a healthcare day at the Pride Center, which is an LGBTQ plus group, and I invited healthcare organizations to the Pride Center to advocate their care. And we had 13 different clinics represented there, 13 different organizations that came to this place to say that they are affirming and they want to make sure that trans individuals, that LGBTQ plus individuals know that they are safe going to these services. And looking around at this room, we have CAS Public Health, we have Red River Women's Clinic, we have Planned Parenthood, we have Sanford Gender Clinic, a lot of organizations representing a lot of the medical community in this area all stepped up and said, we want to do better. And 10 years ago, that wasn't going to happen. 5 years ago, I don't know if that was going to happen. But so many people, at least in the work that I do in terms of medical care, so many directors are having conversations with me asking me, how can we do better for our patients, for our trans patients? And to me, that is an incredible success. That's an incredibly different playing field than what we were 10 years ago. So situations like that give me a lot of hope. In terms of patients, we've had patients say that our services are what save their life. That's how important this care can be for some people. And that is incredible as well. So those are some of the success stories we have with just our clinic, both the medical community seeing what we do and rising up to do better, and our own patients finally having an option they didn't have before.
And, you know, I understand some who identify as transgender can have mental health struggles also.
Yep.
Because of everything they've gone through.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit more about that?
A lot of what happens is that when a trans individual is rejected, that creates a lot of trauma in them. And there's going to be things associated with that, like anxiety or depression. An interesting thing they found is that a transgender individual who was able to indicate early on that they were trans and was treated how they preferred, how they identified, who they were their entire life, they don't have any mental issues different than the general population. As long as individuals can be accepted for who they are, they tend to turn out pretty okay.
Okay. How young is too young to know if one is transgender? You hear stories of parents with children mm-hmm. and at young ages identifying this, and it can be a tricky situation sure. with minors.
No, absolutely. So our gender identity, according to developmental psychologists, is something that develops around 3 years of age. Gender identity is a is part of our neural anatomy. It is our understanding that our brain has of how our body should develop. So there's going to be people as young as 3 and 4 saying, you know, mom, I'm not really a boy, I'm a girl. And for these individuals, sometimes you see in the news, like parents are forcing transition on their kids or something like that. There is no medical intervention that happens for children. There is only a social transition. This often means, you know, cutting your hair short if you're a trans boy. It means growing your hair long if you're a trans girl. And wearing different clothes, hanging out with different friend groups. There is no medical intervention that happens until puberty hits or until intervention needs to happen. So a lot of times, and this, there's a lot that goes into this as well, our diagnostic models for identifying gender dysphoria in youth have gotten better and better. You'll hear the idea that 80% of kids grow out of being trans, and that's not the case. That was actually never the case. That was based on studies looking at gay men and seeing that they didn't grow up to be trans women, and of course that didn't happen. We're still going on that, but for the most part, it happens on a case-by-case basis, and there's no real medical intervention that happens until someone is ready to give consent in some capacity.
Faye, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Faye Seidler of the Harbor Health Clinic, which specializes in trans-specific health care, visiting with John Harris in an excerpt from Prairie Pulse. You can see the show this Friday at 7:30 Central on our television service, and you can find out more about the clinic at harborhealthclinic.org. Coming up on Main Street, Harvest Public Media concludes its reports on farm bankruptcies. And Minot State University alumna Veronica Pinnick is returning to the campus to talk about her work to find life beyond our planet. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The Minnesota House has approved a measure to crack down on distracted driving. It said motorists would only be able to use a hands-free device to place cell phone calls. DFL Speaker Melissa Hortman says Minnesotans deserve to be safe on the roadways.
There's clear evidence from other states that these types of laws save lives. We've heard so many heart-wrenching stories from Minnesotans about family members they've lost because people are on their smartphones instead of focusing on the road.
A similar bill is working its way through the Minnesota Senate. A Grand Forks lawmaker wants to change the way lawmakers can access the earnings from the state's legacy fund. Right now, the earnings go into the state's general fund, but Democratic Representative Corey Mock has introduced a constitutional amendment so that the earnings would be reinvested into the legacy fund. He says that would mean lawmakers would have to have a two-thirds vote in each chamber to spend that money, the same threshold for the fund's principal.
The powers of compound interest are significant, and we've learned a lot of lessons from other states and countries that have had sovereign wealth funds like ours. We've seen them overcommit their earnings too early and really stunt the growth of their sovereign wealth funds, and I want to make sure that North Dakota does not make that same mistake.
Mock says before the legacy fund was created, the state had a permanent oil tax trust fund.
And it became a second general fund. And it didn't take any more than a simple majority for us to deplete that down. And we did. Every 2 years, we would drain every nickel and dime to balance the budget. And that's what we're setting the legacy fund up to be right now.
There is bipartisan support for this resolution. If it passes both chambers, it would be on the ballot in 2020. And a state senator from Mayville has resigned due to health reasons. Republican Arnie Osland cited health problems as his reason for resigning. He is recovering from a stroke. Legislative Management Committee Chairman Senator Ray Holmberg of Grand Forks says he has received a formal letter from Osland with his resignation effective Monday.
I have a letter that will be going to the district chairman, and they have 21 days in which to meet their organization and appoint someone to fill out his term.
Holmberg says that means the person the district party appoints will likely be able to attend the final days of the legislative session, but that's up to the person appointed and to the district chair. Osland's term is up next year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. There's a special bankruptcy code for U.S. family farms titled Chapter 12, which allows farmers to restructure their debt and go back to producing food. However, in the conclusion of Harvest Public Media's look at farm bankruptcy, Esther Honig reports that today's farmers sometimes get so far into the red that there is no relief.
This lobby at an animal sanctuary in northern Colorado is filled with wood shavings, wire cages, and about a dozen chickens. Chrissy DiNardo works here and describes what she saw in January when volunteers rescued 610 birds from a farm owned by a local meat company.
So some of the birds we brought in, they have wounds on their bodies and they were literally being eaten alive.
The chicken farm had gone bankrupt. Owner Chad Anderson told Harvest Public Media that within a day, the government froze the company's assets, even though they had 70,000 chickens and just 3 days' worth of feed.
They started reaching out to wildlife centers and zoos to feed the chickens to their carnivores because they didn't even have the means to send the chickens to slaughterhouses.
Fortunately, financially troubled farms can often find help because there's a bankruptcy code specifically for them. Chapter 12. It was created during the 1980s farming crisis and helps family farms restructure debt and stay in business. But there's a catch, one that partly tripped up the chicken farm. An operation can't have more than about $4 million of debt. In downtown Denver, lawyer Guy Humphreys specializes in Chapter 12. He can even see the federal court from his office on the 14th floor.
Yeah, no, it's a short walk and it's easier for clients and that sort of thing.
Chapter 12 is friendlier than other bankruptcies. Payments are adjusted to meet a farmer's cash flow, and certain types of debt can even be forgiven. But the key really is meeting that $4 million cap. And that can be hard to do at a time when farmers have near record debt. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says it's about $410 billion. And while most family farms still qualify for Chapter 12, The share of those who have too much debt has slowly grown over the last decade.
And I've had several farm cases in the past 2 years that, where their debts were too high.
Most of that debt is due to high cost of land and machinery. A new combine, for instance, will set a farmer back about $400,000. John Newton is an economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation and says Chapter 12 needs an update.
You know, raising the debt limit really needs to reflect how modern agriculture is, how it's changed so much in the last 20 to 30 years.
To solve the problem, Republican Senator Chuck Grassley from Iowa wants to increase the debt limit from $4 million to $10 million. Of course, many Americans may ask, why should big family farms be treated any differently than big business? For starters, says Newton, 98% of U.S. farms are run by families, not corporations. Plus,
agriculture is the only sector of the U.S. economy where Mother Nature is your business partner.
There's a lot of uncertainty in American agriculture due to falling commodity prices and trade disputes with countries like China. But if the ag industry were to tank, raising the debt limit on Chapter 12 could keep more family farms from going under. Over half the chickens on the bankrupt farm were slaughtered and sold. The remaining 30,000 had to be donated or rescued, according to the company. Peter McCoskey volunteered with the Animal Sanctuary to help find new homes for some of them.
When we're talking about animal agriculture, bankruptcy presents this really unique problem because we're not talking about cases of strawberries or cucumbers.
And it's farmers who own chickens or run dairies who are especially vulnerable to bankruptcy because thin profit margins force them to take on more debt. Esther Honig, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaboration that looks at America's farm and rural issues. Coming up next, finding life on distant planets.
Next time on The Pulse, modern medicine has blurred the lines between life and death.
They seem to be biologically alive, but they're never going to wake up again.
This can be a really difficult situation for families.
She started moving around, doing things that dead people aren't supposed to be doing.
The space between life and death.
Thursday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Veronica Pinnick. She is a research associate specializing in scientific instrumentation at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, and she joins us by phone. Thanks for being with us, Veronica.
Oh, thanks. I'm very excited to be here.
One of the reasons we're talking to you is you're coming back to your home state of North Dakota because you're a Minot State University alumna, 2004, with a degree in chemistry. Of course, you went on from there to further your education at Texas A&M and Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. But let's talk a bit about why you're coming back. You're going to give a talk on campus, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm going to focus on some of the chemistry that we do here at Goddard Space Flight Center that takes the experiment out of the laboratory and into space, doing in situ measurements. In situ means at the location that you're taking your instruments, which in this case is Mars, and we'll look forward to other interesting topics like ocean worlds.
The topic of your discussion, which is Thursday at 7 p.m. at Hoffman Auditorium at the Cyril Moore Science Center at Minot State University, is searching for the footprints of life in our solar system using mass spectrometry. What is mass spectrometry?
Yeah, that is a fancy way of just saying a scale. It's a chemical analysis tool that scientists use to try to understand what something is made out of. And in this case, what we do here at the Planetary Environments Lab at Goddard Space Flight Center is study the atmosphere, what the gas that is around a planet is made out of, or we look at the soil and the rocks that we can either access by scooping or drilling and crushing, and we try to understand what the chemistry is that makes up those surfaces.
So you're looking for some chemical evidence that would indicate building blocks of life or actual life itself?
Yeah, so it depends on which mission we discuss, whether we talk about the actual detection of life. That's a complicated thing, and it's a complicated thing to prove.
Yeah.
So, you know, normally what we say is we look for the building blocks, things that are complex organic molecules that are derived from life. We look for something as simple as a functional group for my chemists in the room that show complex chemistry, or things that we're more familiar with, like RNA or DNA or, you know, lipids or things like that that we recognize it in living systems on Earth.
Well, of course, Mars has been explored recently by these magnificent robotic devices that take these high-definition images and show us a very desolate place. Have these recent robotic explorations of Mars and other planets and asteroids discovered any evidence that needs to be followed up?
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I would say, well, obviously I'm biased. I think that any of the science that you collect sheds light on what's happening currently, what happened in the past with some of these planetary targets, how did they form? And, you know, at some point in Mars' history, you know, it used to look a lot like Earth. It was warm. It had standing oceans. And at some point it lost its atmosphere and it lost all traces of surface water, although we do see that sometimes in the form of ice on the polar caps. But we want to try to understand a little bit more about what's going on there so we can understand, you know, how planets form and how they exist the way they do. But moreover, the Curiosity rover is particularly doing amazing science still, you know, in its, I think, sixth year of exploration. And every time it runs an experiment, it finds something new. And so I think some recent data indicates that you know, they found organic molecules on Mars. And again, trying to prove where they came from and what they mean is the work that's, you know, ongoing both in the laboratory and in continued experiments that they're planning for the Curiosity rover. But that's a pretty huge development.
Well, you work on the scientific instrumentation for these kinds of devices, and there's a big one planned next summer, a launch of the space agency's ExoMars rover. What might that be looking for in a different way? I mean, what capabilities will it have that the Curiosity or some other rover did not have?
Yeah, that's a great question. And this one's my heart because this is my baby that I've been working on for about 10 years now. So the ExoMars rover, newly renamed the Rosalind Franklin rover after the crystallographer Rosalind Franklin. So that one is going to go up in this summer, like you said. And the new capability is that it actually has the ability to drill 2 meters below the surface of Mars. And that's going to be the first time that a sample will be brought up from those depths. And why that's interesting is because most of the rovers in the past have been able to either scoop the surface or just drill very few centimeters below the surface. And we know that if we're looking for these nice, juicy biological molecules, that they're really delicate and existing on the surface of Mars with all of the radiation environment that can damage the molecules, or the chemical environment that exists on it has lots of perchlorates, a chemical which can break up the molecules when we analyze them by some of our methods. If they're protected, the further down you go in the soil. So we're hoping if we can find a good location that looks like it had liquid water at some point and maybe is preserved by some clays or things that we know do a good job for protecting those organic molecules, if we can pull them up intact and bring new methods like laser desorption, mass spectrometry, which is basically just firing a laser at the surface and bringing those molecules into our sensors that way, we have the ability maybe to detect very large, complex biological molecules if they exist.
So these previous explorations of the planet, including the surface of the planet, have found some evidence of a water that existed previously or currently exists in parts of the planet, I think on the pole. So is this particular rover looking for what would have been a lake or seabed?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different methods that we can use to find a good spot, not only to land, although that's debated by our planetary scientists and conferences and things like that. But, you know, we take orbital data from the various missions that are orbiting, like, for example, the ExoMars rover has imaging spectroscopy instruments. It's a two-part mission, actually. It has the trace gas orbiter, which is currently orbiting Mars, and then the lander, which is the next step. And so between looking at the geologic formations, looking for riverbeds and deltas, things like that, and then our onboard instruments with our WISDOM radars that can sense water beneath the surface. So we use both of those different methodologies to find a good place where we think we want to drill and study more in detail samples that would come from a drilled location.
Well, when I was a kid, I grew up reading and devouring science fiction. Now we're talking about something even more amazing, science fact. So is the discovery of life in our solar system likely?
Ooh, That's a hard question.
Yeah, because you're actually sending something very expensive to find out. But
I mean,
is this an if or when thing?
I would say, you know, this is a personal opinion. Of course, I don't speak on behalf of NASA when I talk about the possibilities, but I have to believe that we will at some point find some evidence, maybe not of current life in our solar system. It's possible, of course, but remnants of past life are probably more likely. And the challenge, like I said previously, is proving that you didn't bring that life with you and that it originated in its location that you found it, and then proving that it originated from some mechanism that indicates life. I have to believe it's possible. It's why we keep going out there to explore.
It's the most fascinating question of all, I think. And, of course, we would call this alien life. Is it likely to be very basic, like bacterial or viral size, or is there speculation about the existence, previous existence even, of something more complex?
So I think, you know, there are a lot of different forms of studying the existence of life on another planet. One form is this agnostic methodology where you come at it trying not to assume that life means something that it means on Earth. And so you have to be a little more broad-minded in terms of looking for patterns of chemicals or structure of something that you find. But then, of course, it would be the most logical to start with a simple form of something that can exist in the harsh environments of space. You know, Earth is a warm and wet and organic-rich location, so it's natural for us to understand that that's how life forms. But some of these locations that we're exploring are harsher. They have a worse radiation environment, or they exist in a vacuum without, you know, a warm atmosphere around it. And so there are some places on Earth that show that life can still exist in those extreme environments. So I think, you know, trying to understand what we can see on Earth in the harshest of environments that Earth provides is a good starting place to think about what we might be able to find on another planet.
Well, I've seen those videos of these gigantic worm-like things in very deep sea bottoms spouting this black tarry stuff that looks quite alien. We are carbon-based life forms. Is another base possible or likely?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there are some studies that investigate what's possible, what the different building blocks could be. But, you know, again, I think the most natural thing scientists do and humans do are to understand the universe based on what we already know. And so that's probably where we'd start to try to understand. But like I said, coming from an agnostic point of view, bring no bias into the measurements, we should be willing to look at any repeating patterns that give you some indication of complex, you know, formation that would indicate some advanced assembly that would indicate life.
These are remarkable devices that you're sending millions and millions of miles into space and doing very precise things with them and getting the data back. That in itself is science fact that amazes me. Now, I grew up at a time when spaceflight riveted the world's attention, especially manned spaceflight. So do you think a manned flight to Mars would be important to the purpose of discovering life or for some other purposes?
Yeah, so NASA's mission is to send people to Mars at some point in the future. And, of course, that's depending on technology development and our, you know, funding environments and things like that. But there are a few ways I think you're really going to make a big advancement in the exploration of our solar system. We've already done a great job, especially here at Goddard Space Flight Center, of developing these very sophisticated chemistry labs that we send to other planets and do the work on the planet at our location to do the science. What the two paths that you can take to further that even more and that NASA is exploring would be manned space missions, not only to the moon but also to Mars at some point, so that, you know, all of the chemistry that you can do also has a person in the loop, because no matter how smart we make automated technology, sometimes just a scientist's eye looking at data is the best algorithm that you can use to understand what's happening with your experiments. The second path that people maybe aren't as familiar with, and that there's a lot of progress going on these days, is with sample return and going to a location that's somewhat distant and bringing back samples to study and investigate, you know, bringing them back to Earth and using all of the techniques that we have available to us, you know, in our laboratories on Earth, which is hard to send that out to other planets or to other planetary targets. So that's how we're trying to advance things from those two different methodologies.
Well, I think the Japanese have been trying that with an asteroid, I mean, to actually bring some material back, aren't they?
Yep, and in fact, so our folks at NASA, there is a mission called OSIRIS-REx that's going to Bennu, and they have a great website if you want to learn more about sample return and the things that NASA is doing for sample return.
Will this be at NASA.gov?
Just Google OSIRIS-REx, and you can go to the mission website, and they have incredible information there.
All right. Is it a challenge to communicate complicated information to people who don't have doctorates? I mean, you're going to your alma mater, Minot State, to talk about something that is very complex to an audience of mostly lay people, I suppose.
So my graduate school advisor, Emil Schweikert, gave us a good lesson on scientific communication, and that was, if you can't explain it to your grandmother, then you don't understand it very well. and I've really taken that to heart. I mean, I've transitioned a little bit from being in the lab to working in laboratory management and experiment management. And so part of that is understanding how to take something that is extremely complex and boiling it down to what matters. And, you know, for a manager managing a planetary mission, that might be cost and that might be schedule and all of the things that go on in the technical development. But to the public, what I would, as a taxpayer, as a person who's interested in science, be interested in is, what are you doing with the budgets that NASA gets? What kinds of work are you doing and how inspiring can it be? And I think we have the best material to speak from. It, you know, you talk about science fiction and the kinds of work that we're doing is stuff that you wouldn't believe.
Yeah.
And it's you know, the science that's going on here and the complicated instruments that we build and send to other planets, and, you know, we have a target on Mars that's the size of a few football fields, and we're able to land our instruments within that range. I mean, it's just mathematics and physics, and it's amazing that we can do it, but it's happening. And so I think it's you know, in some ways, it's very easy to talk to the public about what we do because it's incredible. And well, I just want everybody to be as excited as we are about that.
Well, it's amazing to be working in a world-class research facility like Goddard. This is Veronica Pinnock. She'll be speaking on the campus of Minot State University Thursday at 7 at the Hoffman Auditorium at the Cyril Moore Science Center. The overarching title is Searching for the Footprints of Life in Our Solar System Using Mass Spectrometry, but there'll be other things as well. Veronica, thank you for talking with us today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Decoded 8 Book is next.
The setting is a beauty salon in small town Louisiana, where all the ladies come to have their hair done and entertain each other with hilarious repartee. But tragedy strikes when the prettiest girl in town, Shelby, loses her life during a risky pregnancy. Now the ladies have to come together with strength and love, and they give this story a special quality, making it truly touching and marvelously funny. Dakota Stage in Bismarck proudly presents Steel Magnolias, March 14th through the 16th and the 21st through the 24th. More information and tickets are available at the door or online at dakotastageltd.com.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Decoded 8 Book for March 19th. Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. Theodore Roosevelt extolled the American West throughout his life, influenced by his adventures with the people of the West from Dakota Territory's Little Missouri River all the way to the Pacific Ocean. He was never shy talking about the ethical standards he adhered to and strove to uphold in his personal, public, and private life. He called out with pride the people he met in the West as being average citizens of the right type. One of his lifelong friends and Dakota Cattle Ranch companions was Bill Seawall from Maine. T.R. helped popularize a phrase he had first heard from Seawall's brother, Dave, and composed a letter about it this week in 1918.
It was from Dave that I heard an expression which ever after remained in my mind. He was speaking of a local personage of shifty character who was very adroit in using fair-sounding words which completely nullified the meaning of other fair-sounding words which preceded them. His words weasel the meaning of the words in front of them, said Dave, just like a weasel when he sucks the meat out of an egg and leaves nothing but the shell. And I always remembered weasel words as applicable to certain forms of oratory, especially political oratory, which I do not admire.
Roosevelt's admiration for the Cowboys can be understood from one of his autobiography entries.
The moral tone of a cow camp, indeed, is rather high than otherwise. Meanness, cowardice, and dishonesty are not tolerated. There is a high regard for truthfulness and keeping one's word, intense contempt for any kind of hypocrisy, and a hearty dislike for a man who shirks his duty. Many of the men gamble and drink, but many more do neither. And the conversation is not worse than in most bodies composed wholly of male human beings. But he does possess, to a very high degree, the stern qualities that are invaluable to a nation.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
A violent white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, made a lot of people who live there very angry. Many of them said notions of civility meant their city council wouldn't hear them out.
So I see civility as an instrument to let people with very strong opinions get things done.
Civility is often used actually to shut down discussion.
Can debate be passionate and civil? On the next morning edition.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Wednesday on Main Street, the film Rosewood Ledge was selected for the Fargo Film Festival. We'll talk with writer-director Trey Chapman and producer Michael Bonini, who also plays a role with actors Maritza Veer and Fargo native Kristen Rudroot. And March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month. Lisa Vig at Lutheran Social Services of North Dakota will join us Wednesday to discuss the brain chemistry of gambling addiction. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Wednesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.